Good day, everyone, and welcome to today's Risk Assessment Statement of Concern press call. At this time, all participants are in a listen-only mode. Later, you will have the opportunity to ask questions during the question-and-answer session. You may register to ask a question at any time by pressing the star and one on your touch-tone phone. Please note that this call may be recorded. It is now my pleasure to turn the conference over to Vinita Gupta. Please go ahead.
Good afternoon, everyone, and thank you for joining this call. I'm Vinita Gupta, President and CEO of the Leadership Conference Education Fund, and the Education Fund builds public will for federal policies and policies that promote and protect the civil and human rights of all persons in the United States. Thank you for joining our press briefing. We're joined on this call by Monique Dixon, Deputy Policy Director of the NAACP Legal Defense and Educational Fund, Jeffrey Robinson, Deputy Legal Director of the American Civil Liberties Union, Scott Roberts, Senior Campaign Director of Color of Change, Mark Holden, Policy Director of the Defender Association of Philadelphia, and Rachel Ferran, Managing Director of the Brooklyn Bail Fund. After a hearing from each of our speakers, we will have a question and answer session, and this session is going to also feature Hannah Sassaman, Policy Director of Media Mobilizing Project, Logan Kepke, Policy Analyst at Upturn, and Andrea Woods, Attorney at the ACLU. America's pretrial justice system is broken. It's systematically biased against and disproportionately impacts low-income people and people of color and allows for frequent violations of the Constitution. Too many people are detained before they even go to trial because they cannot afford to pay a monetary bail. Just look at the numbers. Nearly 500,000 people are in jail on any given day awaiting trial. Recently, policymakers and advocates in nearly every state and many localities have sought to change their pretrial justice systems out of recognition for these injustices. Many jurisdictions are embracing pretrial risk assessment instruments, algorithmic-based decision-making tools. These are statistical tools that use historical data to forecast which defendants can be safely released as a cornerstone of these changes. These tools are often presented as a transparent and equitable alternative to current systems of secured money bail in pretrial detention decision making. However, implementation of these tools has not, in a lot of places, curtailed the continued over-incarceration of people of color before they've gone to trial. People who should otherwise be legally entitled to due process of law before being torn away from their families, homes, and careers. And that's why communities who are advocating for fair and responsible reforms have expressed concerns about these tools. The data driving many predictive algorithms, such as prior failures to appear and arrest rates, reflect the flaws and biases already present in our justice system and, as a result, are profoundly limited. Decades of research have shown that such data primarily document the behavior and decisions of police officers and prosecutors rather than the individuals or groups that the data are claiming to describe. Algorithmic decision-making tools are only as smart as the inputs to the system. And as a result, biases in data sets will not only be replicated in the results, they actually may be exacerbated. For example, since police officers disproportionately arrest people of color, criminal justice data used for training the tools will perpetuate this correlation. Thus, automated predictions based on such data threaten to further intensify unwarranted discrepancies in the justice system and to provide a misleading and undeserved imprimatur of impartiality for an institution that desperately needs fundamental change. Ultimately, the use of these tools could actually undermine the purpose of reform and move us further away from the equality under law. Real reform requires addressing underlying structural inequalities rather than an effort at triaging a structurally flawed system. Pretrial justice reform must significantly reduce arrest rates and money bail, severely restrict pretrial detention, implement robust due process protections, preserve the presumption of innocence, and eliminate racial inequity. The Leadership Conference Education Fund work with a broad coalition of national, state, and local civil rights, digital justice, and community-based organizations to develop a statement of concern. The principles in the statement aim to center community voices that are urging jurisdictions to end money bail and decarcerate most accused people without the use of risk assessment in a way of maintaining public safety in communities. They're also designed to inform decision makers about the consequences of these tools for civil and human rights and provide local communities with more resources and power as they advocate for pretrial systems that are just, fair, and appropriate for their families and communities. And the six principles are as follows. One, pretrial risk assessment instruments must be designed and implemented in ways that reduce and ultimately eliminate unwarranted racial disparities across the criminal justice system. Pretrial risk assessment instruments must never recommend detention. Instead, when a tool does not recommend immediate release, it must recommend a pretrial release hearing that observes rigorous procedural safeguards. Three, neither pretrial detention nor conditions of supervision should ever be imposed except through an individualized adversarial hearing. Four, pretrial risk assessment instruments must be transparent, independently validated, and open to challenge by an accused person's counsel. Five, pretrial risk assessment instruments must communicate the likelihood of success upon release in clear, concrete terms. Six, pretrial risk assessment instruments must be developed with community input, revalidated regularly by independent data scientists with that input in mind, and subjected to regular, meaningful oversight by the community. Pretrial risk assessment instruments should not be seen as a panacea on bail reform. If our goals are to shrink the justice system and end racial disparities, we can't simply end money bail and replace it with these tools, nor can we replace jail with other forms of detention like electronic monitoring. We have to be mindful of trading one injustice for another. And it's important to remember that we're talking about a population and people who haven't been yet convicted of crimes and may never be. The vast majority of people who are arrested can be safely and should be released pending trial. Policymakers can and should allow people to return to their communities while they await trial without screenings from inherently flawed and biased tools. And ending money bail requires a commitment to restoring legitimacy to our institutions, a commitment to racial justice, and a commitment to reform that's driven by people and communities who are most affected by the legal system. Thank you. Now I'm going to turn the call over to Monique Dixon, Deputy Policy Director at the NAACP Legal Defense and Educational Fund.
Good afternoon, everyone. I'm Monique Dixon, and I serve as the Deputy Director of Policy and Senior Counsel at the NAACP Legal Defense Fund. For almost 80 years, we've worked to ensure that our nation's criminal justice laws are administered fairly and without regard to race. We've used litigation and policy reform strategies to address racial discrimination at every stage of the justice system, from arrests to sentencing to reentry. Certainly, no person who's been accused of a crime should be locked up pending trial simply because they cannot pay a bail amount. With this in mind, the Legal Defense Fund has supported local efforts to reduce pretrial detention populations by eliminating money bail systems and taking steps to reduce racial disparities in the detention population. We believe that these goals should be accomplished without the use of risk assessment tools. And we are very concerned that these tools rely on data from a racially biased criminal justice system and will inevitably increase racial disparities in the pretrial detention population. As Vanita stated, risk assessment tools are only as good as the data that goes into them. And most tools consider the criminal justice backgrounds of individuals accused of crimes to determine their risk levels. We know that racial bias in arrests, for example, has been well documented in jurisdictions across the country. Consequently, data derived from biased arrests would make individuals of color who are accused of a crime look riskier than white individuals accused of the same alleged conduct. Risk assessment tools would perpetuate existing racial biases in a criminal justice system that disproportionately target and harm people of color, and that should not be. Instead of relying on risk assessment tools, pretrial detention should be ordered only after a timely individualized adversarial hearing to determine whether an individual is a flight risk. Although risk assessment tools may be viewed as an instrument of release for some, for persons of color, they represent a tool of oppression that unfairly jails presumptively innocent people based on race. For these reasons, the Legal Defense Fund is happy to support the shared statement of civil rights concerns on the use of pretrial risk assessment instruments. Thank you.
Thank you, Monique. Now we'll hear from Jeff Robinson, Deputy Legal Director of the American Civil Liberties Union.
Thank you, Vanita. My name is Jeff Robinson, and I'm a Deputy Legal Director here at the ACLU. No one should ever be held in a jail cell just because she can't pay a sum of money. Quite the opposite, all people should be free to go home to their families and return to their jobs before their day in court. But every day in this country, nearly 500,000 people are incarcerated pretrial. This number means that 70% of the people in U.S. jails today are not there because they have been convicted of a crime, but because they're unable to secure their freedom while they await trial, often because of a bail requirement that they simply can't afford. Because of our over-reliance on money bail, tens of thousands of people every year face an impossible choice: either wait in jail for weeks, months, or years for their day in court, or plead guilty to resume their lives and return to their families. Thus, our punitive and wealth-based system causes massive, unnecessary pretrial jailing, fuels over-incarceration, and destroys lives. Of course, disproportionately, people of color experience the worst of these harms. Yet one of the bedrock principles of our legal system is that everyone is considered innocent until they are proven guilty. Before anyone's pretrial liberty can be infringed, they must be given an individualized hearing before a neutral judge, with a public defender available if they can't afford a lawyer. Jail should always be treated as an absolute last resort. And onerous conditions on pretrial freedom, such as GPS monitoring, should only be imposed if they are the very least restrictive way to free someone. The ACLU fights for this in litigation literally every day. The ACLU is actively working for bail and pretrial reform across the country in 36 states and counties. We have brought 11 legal challenges to oppressive and unconstitutional bail practices, and we're not done. The ACLU was central to policy reform in New Jersey and continues to protect those reforms through litigation. Since implementing changes on January 1st of 2017, New Jersey has increased pretrial release, established robust due process, and required that nearly everyone start from a presumption of freedom pending trial. While New Jersey uses a risk assessment, the important lesson to take from reforms achieved there is that jurisdictions can preserve individual constitutional rights, provide speedy hearings, and ensure that jailing prior to trial is the carefully limited exception as the United States Supreme Court has mandated. We deeply appreciate the tremendous contributions of empirical researchers in this field, and we depend on their work to shine light on how needless money bail and pretrial jailings are. But current risk assessment tools, by definition, don't provide the specific, individualized information needed to make a tailored determination that due process principles require before someone's liberty is infringed. The ACLU is committed to dramatically reducing the number of people jailed pretrial, ending our country's over-reliance on money bail, and combating systematic racism at all stages of the criminal justice system. Everyone should have a fair chance to secure their freedom while they are presumed innocent. And for those reasons, we have signed this important statement of concern.
Thank you, Jeff. Next, we'll hear from Scott Roberts, Senior Campaign Director at Color of Change. Scott, you may be on mute. If you're able to unmute, that would be great.
Yeah. Thanks.
There you go. Okay.
And I do want to thank the Leadership Conference and all of our other friends here on the call, including ACLU and NAACP, who we've already heard from. You know, folks have done such a great job of detailing the issue here and what our concerns are. I really just want to say this, that this is really about fundamental questions of justice. Who gets to be free? Who gets surveilled? Whose rights have to be protected? And for the last several decades, our justice system has increasingly passed the buck on these questions to the commercial bail industry, allowing people to profit from exploiting communities of color poor people. And now the communities have taken action, have started to move and put pressure on our political leaders. We see that folks are looking to technological solutions that recreate the biases already in our system. And we're already seeing that some of these efforts are being put in place, offered up as solutions, but not delivering the outcomes that communities are calling for. At Color of Change, we've been employing a range of tactics to address pretrial detention and issues concerning money bail. And one of the things that we've been most proud of is our work with National Bailout Collective and the Mama's Day Bailout, where we have worked with local community organizations and community leaders to bail out over 300 black people, mostly women, over the last two Mother's Days. One of the things that we've learned in that that work is the and working with those communities is hearing the things that local folks are calling for. Our communities need policies and practices that reverse mass incarceration, not ones that reinforce the racism already in the system. Until we address the inherent racism in our justice system and focus on meeting the needs of our communities, technological solutions like risk assessments continue to fall short. That means we have to end money bail, including any financial restriction on pretrial release. We have to shift from a perspective that assumes risk to one that focuses on need. We and our families and communities are not risks. We have to respond to individuals and communities in crisis by interrogating their needs, and we agree that that means we have to invest in our communities, more resources for education, healthcare, jobs, less spending on police and prisons. We need to be decriminalizing. We need to stop arresting, prosecuting, and sentencing so many people. And an unfounded belief in risk assessment tools is not going to address the fundamental issues that have created the crisis of over-incarceration. And so for those reasons, we're very happy to have signed on to this shared statement of civil rights concerns on risk assessment. And again, I want to thank all of our friends on the call for their efforts in making this and helping bring this together. Thank you.
Thanks, Scott. Now we'll hear from Mark Holden, Policy Director of the Defender Association of Philadelphia.
Thank you. The Defender Association represents nearly every person at their initial bail hearing in Philadelphia, which amounts to over 40,000 people a year. We see every day the crisis that the current bail system has confronted us with. It is a deep and complex problem without one simple solution. The money aspect of bail is deeply troubling. However, the true problem is the frequency with which we use pretrial incarceration and the race of those incarcerated. To solve this problem, we need a systemic solution, not the promise of a solution that an algorithm gives us. Pretrial decision-making is a rushed process with little to no ability to obtain individualized information from those who are accused. We lose what the individual's strengths are, and we lose sight of what these individuals will lose if they are detained pretrial. In a fear-driven process, the labels that risk assessment tools often create prevent an individual's ability to be seen as a person, rather than someone who's interchangeable with people who've come before them. Once you label someone high risk, it becomes the defining characteristic of that person and the lens through which the justice system sees them. For example, in juvenile court in Philadelphia, we do have a risk assessment tool, yet we have seen that over 95% of the kids labeled high risk are detained. Once someone is labeled high risk, it's a near certainty that they will in fact be incarcerated. Oftentimes, proponents of risk assessments say that the tools are just one factor to be considered. However, charge type, for example, is one of about 10 factors that's allowed to be considered in Pennsylvania. However, we see day in and day out that it is typically the only factor that determines release or detention. We believe the same is true of pretrial risk assessment scores. Finally, Philadelphia had been leading the nation in incarceration of the 10 biggest cities in the country, but we've dramatically slashed our incarceration rate by over 34% with plans to close one of our local jails. This is what can happen when stakeholders work together to find creative solutions, and this was all done without the use of a risk assessment tool. These principles are the most comprehensive explanation of the problems that risk assessment tools present and ways to mitigate those harms if a risk assessment tool is in use, and therefore we are pleased to sign on to the document.
Thank you, Mark. And last, we'll hear from Rachel Foran, Managing Director of the Brooklyn Bail Fund.
Thanks so much. Hi, everyone. I'm Rachel Foran, Managing Director at the Brooklyn Community Bail Fund. We're a nonprofit that pays bail for folks that cannot afford it in New York City and fights for the abolition of the money bail system. Over the past 3 years, we've paid for over 3,000 New Yorkers who would have been jailed for their poverty alone. Just a bit about our experience with New York City's pretrial risk assessment tool. So after someone's arrested in New York City, as they wait for their arraignment in criminal court, they're interviewed by the city's pretrial services agency, and they're provided with a score. It's intended to indicate whether or not this person is at risk of missing court dates in the future. The numerical score someone gets aligns with the recommendation provided to the judge. They're either recommended for release or they're not recommended for release, and that's bail or pretrial supervision or detention of some form should be considered. Categories that impact the defendant's score include information on their employment, confirmed community contacts, their residence, and previous history of returning to court. Our results and experience on the ground calls into question the ability of this tool to assess actual risk. We looked at a representative sample of our clients. 88% of them were judged moderate to high risk of flight, and they were not recommended for release. Yet once we paid their bail and they were out, free to fight their case and returned to their court dates on their own accord, they made 95% of their scheduled court appearances. All we did was provide phone call court reminders. I spoke with one client last week who was not recommended for release by the tool because he was unemployed and because he didn't have family in the courtroom. After we paid his bail, he made 3 court dates and his case was completely dismissed. This man was struggling with unemployment and economic instability, but not with keeping court appointments. About whether he would return to court, this tool could not have been more wrong. Our experiences paying bail show that people make their court dates. They just do. And they have better case and life outcomes when free pretrial. At the Brooklyn Community Bail Fund, we've signed on to these principles because we believe that we can abolish money bail without replacing it with biased risk assessment instruments. And in circumstances where tools are already in use, as they are in New York City, to influence bail decisions, they should absolutely be subject to community oversight for transparency and accuracy, and they should only be used if proven to substantially reduce numbers of people in jail pretrial or to reduce, if not eliminate, racial disparities that are rampant across our system. And this is especially relevant to us in New York City as we're in the process of evaluating this tool and as we talk about ending money bail through the legislature next year. What's really clear from our experience is that presumptively innocent people should be free to return to their communities and fight their cases from a position of freedom. They should not be held in a cage or under any other type of supervision, whether because of the inability to afford bail or because of demonstrably biased and inaccurate algorithms. Thank you.
Thank you, Rachel. And we're now going to open it up to questions. And operator, if you could please provide instructions. And for reporters, I would ask that you please note if your question is directed to a specific speaker.
At this time, if you would like to ask a question, please press star and one on your touch tone phone. You may withdraw your question at any time by pressing the pound key. Once again, to ask a question, please press star one now. And we will pause a moment to allow questions to queue. Oh, Colleen, your line is open. Can you check your mute function, please?
Okay, I'm here.
There we go. We can hear you now.
Okay. Yes, hi. This is Colleen O'Day with New Jersey Spotlight. I noticed that one of the speakers mentioned New Jersey, and we have reduced the number of people who are being held pretrial, but we do also use a risk assessment tool. So I'm just wondering, is our tool better than others? Do we have other safeguards in place, or should New Jersey be looking at its risk assessment tool as well and perhaps not use this tool?
Thanks, Colleen. I'm going to ask my colleagues, Jeff or Andrea at the ACLU, to respond to that question.
Yeah, hi, Colleen. This is Andrea Woods with the ACLU.
Hi.
And hi. Yeah, thanks for your question. So we, the risk assessment tool that's in place in New Jersey, the public safety assessment or the PSA, you know, I the statements articulated in this document about the use of historic data to generate an algorithmic prediction are equally true for the public safety assessment tool as for many others that exist across the country. It's the ACLU's position that some tools are more problematic than others. And so, you know, while I'm hesitant to say that New Jersey shouldn't look at its tool, we're aware of tools that have even more problematic concerns, such as the inclusion of age at first arrest as an input, which the PSA does not include. But having said that, yes, as Jeff kind of stated earlier, we believe that the most promising element of the New Jersey reform, in which members of people who advocated for New Jersey's reform on the ground continue to emphasize now that we've seen such great results, are the fact that New Jersey's reforms provide such robust due process protections, such individualized hearings. People have the right to discovery pretrial before their pretrial liberty is determined. So it's for those reasons. It's for the fact that there's such care taken to the vindication of people's individual and constitutional rights, not the tool, that we believe we should hold New Jersey up as an example.
Hi, this is Logan Kepke from Upturn. I can also say one thing about the New Jersey experience, and I completely agree with everything that Andrea just said. One thing that's interesting to note is that while it's true that New Jersey's pretrial detention population has decreased since reforms were enacted, it's also true that those decreases were underway before a risk assessment tool was implemented. So it's very unclear to sort of clearly state that the pretrial detention population is going down as a result of the implementation of a risk assessment tool. I think while there has been sort of substantial due process safeguards put in place, I think New Jersey has also seen sort of a new troubling trend where a substantial number of individuals are placed on conditions of release like electronic monitoring or on the highest conditions of release that are not electronic monitoring. And if you compare sort of the imagined or the scenario of how many people should be released on their own recognizance or the conditions of release that are the most minimal, there's been sort of a dramatic swing in New Jersey to placing more conditions of release on individuals. And I think the New Jersey judiciary noted as much that sort of this is causing the state to spend a lot of money and they're going to have to find some sort of new dedicated funding source because so many individuals are being placed on burdensome conditions of release.
Thanks. And this is Hannah from Media Mobilizing Project. I also just wanted to note, I also fully agree with what Andrea and Logan just brought up. The tool that's currently in use in New Jersey, the PSA, has also been deployed in Kentucky, for example. And I think that the context that Logan just brought up, that it's really about the culture change and the other systemic changes that people are doing to push for decarceration, right? And again, here in Philadelphia, we've gotten, you know, 37% of our jail population decreased with a plan to close the jail without risk assessment. It's really about that. In Kentucky, for example, where a researcher named Megan Stevenson, who's based at George Mason University, studied the implementation of the PSA. She found that there was not a decarceral impact over time, and that after 6 months, that judges reverted to their own bail-setting behavior, and they didn't reduce racial disparities. So it's really about an intention and a vision for giving people their due process in court, not about the potential false promise of a risk assessment algorithm.
Okay. Thanks, Colleen. Next question.
And our next question comes from Tony Punj with the McClancy newspaper. And
hello, it's Tony Pugh, McClancy Newspapers. I wanted to ask you guys if what cities, counties around the country are currently considering reforms to their money bail systems and are now studying these algorithmic instruments as a possible replacement to their current system. And I'm also wondering if this issue has made it into the congressional debate about sentencing reforms and whether or not there's any plan to sort of included in that debate.
Thanks, Tony. So, Scott or Hannah, can you talk a little bit about the reforms that are happening around the country, the places that we see reforms happening, and then we'll take the question around federal legislation.
Scott, you want to do that, or should I?
Go ahead.
So I can start, and I think that there's a lot of expertise on this call. Again, this is Hannah and Media Mobilizing Project. In the last 5 years, legislators in all 50 states and many localities, cities like Pittsburgh, cities like Houston, have made changes to their pretrial justice system. You can take a look at the National Council of State Legislatures to get a more comprehensive list, as well as the Pretrial Justice Institute. The point that we're, I think we're trying to make is that you don't need to exchange money bail, ending of money bail, for risk assessment algorithms. And what we're trying to do is to paint pictures both of a lack of correlation between those two things, as well as opportunities and visions that are happening around the country as well to try to end the extraordinary unfair practice of the use of money bail without implementing a risk assessment algorithm that by definition is trained on a practice of criminal justice that is unfair, biased, and racist at its core. So I just wanted to put that out and to give you those resources for where you can find those pieces of legislation. And then pass it back to Sakura for the federal question.
Oh,
thanks, Hannah.
Hey, this is Andrea with just one brief fact to chime in so in support of what Hannah just said. A fact that the Pretrial Justice Institute offered recently, just to illustrate the scale of risk assessments in use today, is that 1 in 4 people in the United States lives in a jurisdiction where their pretrial liberty would currently be influenced in some way by a risk assessment tool. So just wanted to offer that.
Thanks, Andrea. And to the question around federal legislation, there are a number of pieces of legislation pending in Congress, both in the House and the Senate side, by different members. And we're encouraged that policymakers at all levels are committed to ending money bail at the state and local level in particular. What we want to ensure is that in doing so, we are not implementing new policies that are actually making the problems worse, which is why the statements of concerns that we're releasing today are so important. And so as people consider whether it's at the federal level, at the state level, or at the local jurisdictional level, ending money bail, and we hope that that will happen, that if they are looking at alternatives and that include risk assessment tools, that they must look at our statement and they must refer to the principles outlined in the statement and hopefully adopt those tools in light of those concerns and those principles. And that was Sakura Cook at the Leadership Conference on Civil and Human Rights. I'm a senior counsel here.
Thank you.
Next question.
Yes, and I would just like to remind everybody that once again, to ask a question, please press star and one on your touchtone phone. Our next question comes from Emily Hammer with the Wisconsin Center for Investigative Journalism. Please go ahead.
Hi. Hi, everyone. I'm Emily, and I'm with the Wisconsin Center for Investigative Journalism. My question is about, you guys are talking about how it's necessary for this issue to sort of drive a culture change. And I think with a lot of people that I've talked to so far, they point to that a key to this issue is getting judges to change the way that they make their decisions. And I think that some people have pointed out to me that you can't just force judges to make better decisions. And so I think that a lot of people see risk assessment tools as a way to encourage judges to release more people, especially in Wisconsin, where in our criminal justice coordinating councils, they are aware of the risks of the tools and they're updating data to make sure that some of your concerns aren't happening. So my question is, how do you get judges to buy into that culture without a risk assessment tool? What other ways can we force judges to just make better decisions? I think that some people don't think that, or some people think that risk assessment tools are the best way to do that right now.
Thanks. That's a great question. Mark, do you want to answer that?
Yes, sure. Thank you for that question. I can say that in Philadelphia, for example, there are a lot of procedural changes that have yet to be made. And I don't know the contours of Wisconsin's pretrial justice system. But for example, attorneys in Philadelphia don't have an opportunity to actually consult with the person accused before the bail hearing occurs. Without the appropriate use of counsel, obviously, the pretrial release system is going to be less fair and the number of people detained will be much higher. Additionally, there's not clear standards about what level of evidence is required to detain someone pretrial and when you can use certain factors like someone's perceived dangerousness. So I think the first question is what other reforms can occur before bringing in a risk assessment tool that would change the process and thereby change decision making. But also, if a risk assessment tool is being used, I think what the principals do is present a way that they can be used to retrain judges without the harmful effects that risk assessment tools typically bring with them. The tools would have to be calibrated to drastically reduce the number of people detained pre-trial, not simply shift who is detained from one group to another. So if you are to change the culture of judges, I think it's both a structural change as well as a sort of mindset change. And I do just also want to point out that the piece about community involvement is also really critical. And the more people in the community understand the decisions that occur, the more they're able to help hold judges accountable as well.
This is Hannah also, Hannah Sassman from Philadelphia. And yeah, let me just talk a little bit about how it works now here. And I know this is also how it works in New York. So Rachel, you might want to jump in after this. Like when I was arrested, and I've been arrested before, I was, had my hands cuffed, taken to a police station, and eventually taken to a holding cell, like a sort of central location where I was held for well over a day. I was arrested for doing a civil disobedience. There were other women in the cell with me. Across the hall from me, there was, most of the women with me were white. And across the hall from me, there was a woman who was black, who was obviously teeming in some kind of either physical or spiritual pain. When I was brought before a bail magistrate, it was the middle of the night. It was over a video camera. He looked at me for 30 seconds and decided to send me home on my own recognizance. I also heard the case of the woman across the hall, across the jail cell hall, and she was set a money bail and sent back to her cell. These are decisions that take 30 seconds or less in the city of Philadelphia, and I know that this is true around the country. What we're talking about is clearing those out, making sure that we're sending the vast majority of people home, listening to people like Rachel who can prove through the bail fund experience that Scott was mentioning, through the national bailout experience, that what most people need is their needs met, their human needs met, and not to be considered by the definition of hundreds of years of racist data that they are risky. Instead, we need to bring more people home and make the decision to incarcerate one that includes a lawyer that has time to spend with you, a fully adversarial hearing with the right to bring evidence so the judge is making a decision based on truly a fair argument. That's what we're talking about. And I don't know if you have anything to add to that, Rachel, from your experience in New York.
Thanks, Hannah. Yeah, I would just say along very similar lines, right? I mean, with in New York, where we have a pretrial risk assessment system, an interview that happens before folks see the judge that lasts about 2 minutes, right? This client I was speaking to last week spoke quite powerfully to this idea that he was asked a series of questions without being able to give context about who he was, his life, and the fact that he was committed to and has made court dates in the past, instead was judged based on, you know, factors having to do with whether or not he had a job or a stable residence, which he just did not at that time, and the fact that he had missed one court date in the past for reasons why some of us miss appointments, right? When we do miss stuff, it's usually because, in his case, he had a family emergency, or some of my other clients, they couldn't skip work that day, or they couldn't afford transportation. So when we talk about meeting needs to actually address the things that we think socially are important, which I guess is, you know, coming back to court dates, it's about thinking about what those things are and providing them for folks so they can come back to court. But in this case, it was such a short time for him to even be able to answer these questions. He then had to see the judge, who then made a determination based on things on paper and not really based on the reality of what my client was able to do, which was then come back to all of his court dates in the future. And he should have been given the opportunity to do so without having to have money handed over in exchange.
And hi, this is Andrea Woods with the ACLU. I just wanted to offer that the empirical evidence that we have so strongly supports everything that Rachel is saying and that the people who Rachel's describing have experienced. Nationwide, only about 1.5% of people released pretrial are ever arrested for a crime of violence. And some of the tools that exist on the market right now, what high risk means, even by this tool's estimation, is still a 90% or greater likelihood of not being arrested for a crime of violence or any crime. So I think another way that judges need to participate in this culture change is just to become aware of the overwhelming success that most people will experience if they're just given the opportunity.
And we should remember, this is Hannah.
I'm sorry. I just wanted to say, because you mentioned that most people have an overwhelmingly high probability of success pretrial. Isn't that what the risk assessment tools point out and make explicit to judges?
So this is Hannah. Here's one example about the sort of disconnect between how we might define the idea of risky, sort of in common sense language, and how these tools define it. And folks on the call, correct me if I'm wrong, but it is my understanding that for the PSA, for example, which is calculating three different scores, one if you're going to potentially not show up for court date, one if you're going to get arrested again, and then one with a flag if you might be arrested again with a violent charge. The definition of high risk for getting arrested again with a violent flag is, I believe, between 6 and 11% at the highest scales of the pretrial safety assessment of the Arnold Foundation PSA. I believe that that's pretty low risk. I believe that if I'm 6 to 11% likely to do something, I'm probably not going to do it. But what those tools are communicating in a fast-paced environment is the definition, that term high risk, right? And we see that applied to tools as applied to pretrial decision-making as well as sentencing all over the United States. What we're saying is that people have the right to an individualized pretrial determination, especially when they're innocent until proven guilty. We also have to understand that detention and money bail just don't work. For every 3 months that you're locked up, and we've had people here in the city of Philadelphia who spent many months in pretrial detention, you are 5% more likely to recidivate, to get arrested again if released. If you are held on a money bail, you're twice as likely to get a conviction on your record, which is going to mark you for the rest of your life and make you more likely to recidivate. What we're saying is that what we need is individualized conversations and a presumption of release for the vast majority of people if we are truly going to try to transform our criminal justice systems at the pretrial point, and that risk assessment algorithms, rather than always lifting up that information, have a tendency to bury it, with the example that I just gave.
Uh-huh.
Thanks, Hannah. We're going to take the next question.
And our next question comes from Scott Sackford with Reason Magazine. Please go ahead.
Hello, everyone. I have a sort of a strategic question, I guess, a little bit. I'm out here in California where there's legislation to try to eliminate cash bail in California as well. And I'm seeing representatives from the bail industry or proxies attacking it here and also in Alaska, which has followed in New Jersey's footsteps. And they're attacking the algorithms from the other direction, the idea that algorithms are going to free dangerous people. So I guess this is sort of a strategic question. Are there any concerns on your end that this message, these concerns about the use of algorithmic tools can be commandeered to stop bail reform?
Hi, this is Sakira Cook at the Leadership Conference. I'm going to ask my colleagues, Hannah or Mark, to jump in. But what I would say is that the point of the statement of concerns is to articulate what a vision for pretrial justice looks like for the communities that are most impacted by the justice system, and to ensure that as jurisdictions are thinking about ending money bail, as they should, and abolishing money bail, as they should, that they are doing so with the community's voice in mind and are centering what the ultimate goals of reform are in mind. And anyone who attempts to use that framing as a way to undermine those goals, I think it will be seen as that, right? As an attempt to detract away from really reforming our justice system in the ways that help people and are not in line with what the statement is about, quite frankly. And Hannah and or Mark, do you have anything to add?
This is Mark. What I'll say is that the bail bond industry typically says that what people's right is the right to money bail. That's completely wrong and false. What people's right is to be released pretrial. And they're continuing the fear-mongering approach by trying to scare people into rejecting a reform, and just because that overlaps with our, what I believe is a much more reasoned and evidence-based position, I don't think we're going to shy away from it as a result.
Thanks, Mark. I'll take the next question.
And our next question comes from Matthew Bilisher, who is a private reporter. Please go ahead.
Yeah, hi. So I guess this sort of adds on to the idea of culture change with the judges, and I'm thinking about the data scientists that actually use these or create these risk assessment tools? And are there data scientists included in your coalition? How can data scientists be reached to inform them about the biases in the criminal justice system? Because, you know, people creating the tools are probably looking to make decisions less biased, but it seems that a political argument has to be made to them, the people creating the tools the reform they need to make has to be aware of the disparities that are going into their models and even consider it in their models if they're hired to do these things.
So some of your question was breaking up. I think there was a disconnect with the phone, but what I heard you ask was who are the data scientists that we have been working with, what groups those are, and I'll give you a few, but we can get you a fuller list after this call. So Upturn, which is an organization that does data and policy together, who are represented on the call by Logan Kepke. Data and Society is an organization we work very closely with around these principles, development of these principles. Center for Media Justice is an organization that we work with, and we've consulted several researchers like Megan Stevenson, who wrote the report on the tool that was used in Kentucky. But again, I'll send you a fuller list. I didn't catch the last part of your question, so if you want to say it again, hopefully I can throw it to someone else.
Matthew, also, this is Hannah. Like, I can also say that some of the folks from our list are some of the most staunch advocates for digital justice, who are data scientists and advocates who work with data scientists. I believe that Data and Society was mentioned. We also have Electronic Frontier Foundation on this list, if you take a look at Twitter, we have folks like Meredith Whitaker from AI Now and Google who are promoting this. People who design these tools are actually extraordinarily clear that they're not objective, that they're not evidence-based necessarily. They have the same biases that people do. We determine what factors are used. We train the algorithms to weight things that we think are important and to find patterns that we define as risky. What Mark and what others have brought up is that it's the communities, both people who survive harm, survivors of violence, as well as people who survive mass incarceration, who should be working with full transparency with their elected officials, with criminal justice decision makers to decide what safety looks like. And so this is just one piece of a massive national conversation on what that means. And all of the different groups on this call, as well as the over 110 signers of our statement of concerns, are working to make that happen. We just deeply don't want to turn around in 20 years, see the vast majority of people being surveilled on electronic monitors that they pay for themselves, being categorized into definitions of risk or not risky that are based on the same biases that have been, you know, plaguing our society for generations. We say no, and we say no right here.
This is Logan Kepke from Upturn. I think I think part of the sort of question as you're breaking up is how can data scientists help judges sort of with this culture change? I think one thing that judges should feel empowered to do is sort of ask what is in the data set of different tools, whether it's being locally developed or being adopted nationally. I think judges would find it very interesting to see, okay, what does it actually mean when we're talking about rearrest or a new conviction or a failure to appear? What are we actually talking about at sort of the aggregate level? And what are sort of the racial and ethnic sort of breakdowns across those groups? I don't think that that's something that's being done today. And I think that's one way in which judges could sort of be empowered to learn about sort of the problematic data underlying a lot of this. I also would sort of push back to say that I don't think you necessarily need a data scientist to tell you that a lot of the underlying data here is problematic. So consider New York City. They're attempting to build a new risk assessment tool, and they've said that the source data for that new model would come from 2009 to 2015. But I think anyone knows that the city's arrest practices during part of that period were held as unconstitutional and therefore should not be a reliable guide legally or statistically to who should be arrested in the future. So I'm very excited that there are different data scientists that can help equip judges to ask the right type of questions. But I also think that there, if sort of different legal actors sort of take a step back and say, okay, what do I imagine this data actually reflects? I think that they'll sort of come away with a lot of the same concerns that this group shares.
And this is Vanita Gupta from the Leadership Conference. Just to underscore Logan's point, I mean, I think it's important that that we all recognize that there's a range of different types of risk assessment tools that are more or less data-driven and that create more or less injustices in the system. I think that the common thread, though, here is the importance of understanding that the risk assessment instruments alone, as we said, are no panacea for broad pretrial justice reform to really get out of the problems that we're seeing systemically around over-incarceration, criminalization of poverty, and the like, things that are practices that are unconstitutional, and that they have to, you know, for the success of a risk assessment instrument in a jurisdiction that decides to employ it, yes, it has to be data-driven, but it has to actually also be alongside a number of other reforms, such as looking at arrest practices, looking at the conditions that are being set to severely restrict decisions to let people out into the community awaiting adjudication, looking at due process protections and the presumption of innocence and where and how these tools may exacerbate racial disparities. And these are part of a broader spectrum of issues that jurisdictions that, you know, like New Jersey, which we've held up, I mean, they took a much broader, more comprehensive view of pretrial reform and pretrial justice, and it's been an important component in which to contextualize the use of a risk assessment instrument and whether it's successful at actually reducing pretrial detention and racial disparities.
Next question, please.
And our next question comes from Don Kawamoto with Government Technology.
Yes, hi, sir. Yeah, my question is pretty straightforward. I'm wondering, with the statement that you have, what's next with it? What will you do now that you have 100 signatures? How will you leverage that?
Thanks. That's a great question. I'm going to ask Scott or Rachel to answer that question. Scott and Rachel to answer that question, and I'll follow up with any additional points. Hey, guys, you're on mute if you're speaking.
This is Scott. I'm sorry. I missed the question. Did you say it again?
How are we going to leverage the signers of the principles in jurisdictions across the country? How will we be able to activate this amount of energy and power to make the changes we want to see in the system?
Great. That's a great question. Thank you. Thanks, Sarah. For me, I'm very excited. You know, Color Change, we are working with grassroots partners and our members across the country, building out teams to hold local elected officials, especially accountable in the criminal justice system, with a specific focus on prosecutors. Saying that to say that, you know, in the conversations that we have with prosecutors, we're often, they're often thinking about risk assessment. For instance, in Baltimore, the state attorney, Marilyn Mosby, has got funding to address pretrial detention. It's working on a risk assessment tool. And, you know, we express our concerns about that. I think a tool like this gives us the opportunity, to put something in their hands that really gives folks a detailed explanation of the objections. And for folks who are moving forward with those types of tools, it lays out some really clear parameters. I think we can hand that to the decision makers themselves. We can hand that to community partners. We'll be sharing this with our members, our 1.3 members around the country who are actively working to hold prosecutors accountable. And I think, you know, it gives us some solid footing and some shared language and ideas in terms of, in terms of how we want to address this issue. I think there's a lot of opportunity to work with this document and to affect real change and stop some of the things that we're concerned about.
Thanks, Scott. Rachel, anything to add?
Sure. I mean, I would just say from the local context or from my context in New York City, and this is along the lines of what Scott just mentioned, right? I mean, I think this is these principles give a guideline or a starting point for a conversation on a community level, right, in terms of political and legal education of sort of what we should be looking for and what is already happening, right? I mean, I don't think most people understand that this risk assessment tool that we have in place right now operates in the way that it does. And for us, as we do specifically DA accountability work through a court watch program that we run, introducing, having folks be on the lookout for this when they're sitting in the courtrooms and understanding how it works in practice increases transparency around just in general how the criminal legal system is functioning and impacting lives on a daily basis. And I think also, as we said, right, New York City is in the process of reevaluating this tool and other such tools to be used for different risk assessment processes here. And thinking about the legislature changes next year as well, having these guidelines to give to decision makers and to folks really who are sitting in the room is fundamental for making sure, for ensuring that we get the outcomes that we want from the advocacy community.
Thanks you both. So we'll take the last question for today.
All right. Our last question comes from Alicia Richards with Injustice Watch. Please go ahead.
Hi, I wanted to ask, we have seen resistance to reforms that would reduce the number of cases that are pled out rather than going to trial, with people talking about kind of criticism based in the idea that such reforms would take a lot of time and resources. And I'm wondering what kind of response you would have to that kind of opposition to better bail hearings, and whether you've seen any cities implement the kind of individualized hearings that you've been talking about.
Hannah or Mark?
I can start briefly for Philly, and then Mark can get a little bit deeper. So yeah, as a reminder, we've had a massive partnership here in the city of Philadelphia of everyone from probation and parole to the judges to the defenders to the DA's office and the mayor to say, we're just going to try to reduce our jail population. They've done it in multiple different ways, like implementing something called five-day bail hearings, where if you're in jail, 5 days later after your bail has been set, if it meets some different criteria, probably your bail is too expensive and we're going to start sending you home. We're trying to start to prove to an America that's trained on law and order, right? I mean, both the television show, actually, as well as the sort of concept that Jeff Sessions and Donald Trump put out, that's trained to believe that human beings, especially those of color and especially those who are poor, are inherently scary. We're trying to change the narrative, and I think that the National Bailout Project and Color of Change in particular have been truly experts at this, that what human beings are human, and that when you help to meet their needs and support them, they can have their day in court in an extraordinarily safe way. And so I think it's really important to put that out, and that kind of culture change can happen without an algorithmic risk assessment. That we think our model is a really good start, but now we're going to be working because the city of Philadelphia wants to implement the kind of algorithm that is impossible for any human being or their attorney to defend against. We're going to continue to push to say we don't need an algorithm of that nature, but if one happens, it requires the kind of transparency and power from an impassionate community that wants an end to mass incarceration to truly control it and test it for decarceral and, you know, anti-racist results.
Thanks, Hannah. Monique or Jeff, do you want to add anything to that?
Hi, Andrea with the ACLU here. I just wanted to also lift up, this is spoken to earlier in the call, but reforms that divert people out of the criminal justice system entirely, the use of citation in lieu of arrest and the decriminalization of things that don't need to be criminalized all result in the instant vindication of the rights we're describing and certainly a savings. And just to also add, in my capacity litigating issues of wealth-based attention around the country, I'm frequently discussing evidence around the costs of pretrial detention as compared to pretrial supervision. Jailing someone for a day costs 10 times more than supervising them through something like a pretrial services agency. And while there are necessary further reforms needed to systems like those in the federal system, Washington, D.C., Kentucky, and New Jersey, those all demonstrate that still, you know, creating support so someone can be free pretrial is ultimately more affordable for jurisdictions.
Thanks, Andrea. Well, we want to thank everyone again for joining today's call and for the questions, the very insightful questions that you all had. If you have additional questions, please don't hesitate to reach out to us at press@civilrights.org. That is P-R-E-S-S at C-I-V-I-L-R-I-G-H-T-S.org. Thank you all again for joining the call. Have a good day.